From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Hong Kong student protesters call off talks with the government following violent clashes. Islamic State militants continue their offensive against a Kurdish town in northern Syria. And Dallas, Texas copes with the disease Ebola. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. In Hong Kong, pro-democracy student protesters have called off talks with the government after violent clashes broke out today with opponents of the demonstrations. The Hong Kong Federation of Students said today it had no choice but to cancel the talks. Previously, demonstrators had threatened to call off the talks if action was not taken to protect the students, saying organized attacks on demonstrators must stop. Chaotic scenes broke out today at previously peaceful sites in the territory. Hong Kong police intervened after pro-democracy protesters and frustrated residents who opposed the week-long protests engaged in fights. The scuffles began when hundreds of supporters of Communist Party rule attacked a protest site in the Mong Kok neighborhood, smashing tents and tearing down banners. I spoke with VOA correspondent Brian Padden, who was there when the confrontations took place.
So I'm in the district of Mong Kok right now, and there is a big confrontation between they've called themselves workers and businessmen who are sick and tired of all the pro-democracy activists taking over the city. And there's been a lot of pushing and shoving. The anti-student protesters are trying to dismantle these structures and trying to attack the student protesters. The police are actually trying to stand in between them. The police have circled the student protesters and are protecting them. It's a very volatile situation. Just these angry individuals. No one's sure who they are, where they come from. They say they're businessmen and workers from the area. A couple people we talked to, that's what they told us. We don't know if there's any sort of organization to why they're here. They said they heard something on TV and they all came running. And they just had enough. They've been waiting for this opportunity to express how angry they are about this democracy movement thing and how they feel like the students have been used by other groups. And while they may be innocent, they're going to make life much more difficult for everyone.
When did this break out, Brian? When did this violence break out?
This broke out this afternoon. We were downtown in the heart of the main city of Hong Kong, near where the government buildings are, earlier today, and things were very quiet and there were very few protesters, and it was raining very hard early in the day and everybody had to go seek shelter. And so it was a very, it seemed like after a day after the near confrontation between police forces and the protesters, when they gave a deadline to the chief executive to either step down or give in to their demands, or they were going to occupy government buildings. And a day after the chief executive said that he wanted to start a dialogue with the students, all started to seem calm this morning. But now we have this other conflict happening now between people who don't support the protesters, people who want these protests to end, and the students who say they will not move.
Now, this, I believe, though, has been a day off in Hong Kong. It was a government day off.
No. Today is a work day. Today's the first work day back. So it's supposed to be the last 2 days were holidays, and today was the first day back to what was supposed to be a normal work day. There was some thought process and was going through most people's mind was that the government leaders wanted the student protest to kind of dissipate on its own, and we're going to give them time at least till Monday and maybe even longer. They actually pledged that they were not going to use force against the protesters as long as they didn't try to occupy government buildings. So this is a whole different wrinkle.
Okay, and one other thing I did want to ask you. I believe that Mong Kok is in Hong Kong, the sort of working class area of the city?
Yes. Yes, it's more the working class area, and I'm told that it's more Chinese area, and it's a more of an area where mainland Chinese come to.
That's VOA correspondent Brian Padden reporting from Hong Kong. Islamic State militants are continuing their offensive on a Kurdish town in northern Syria, where Kurdish fighters have been trying for weeks to hold on to the territory. Despite recent airstrikes from a U.S.-led coalition, shelling and smoke were seen and heard near the town of Kobani, also known as Ain al-Arab. The fighting is near a recently opened border crossing with Turkey, where more than 160,000 refugees have crossed into the country to avoid the violence. And hundreds of Kurdish fighters have entered Syria from Turkey to join the fighting. Well, meanwhile, the Australian government has authorized airstrikes against Islamic State targets in Iraq. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says IS has declared war on the world and must be degraded and disrupted. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australian warplanes are expected to begin bombing missions inside Iraq within days. Canberra has already sent 600 troops and 6 fighter jets to a US base in the United Arab Emirates. Prime Minister Tony Abbott says Australian commandos will be deployed to northern Iraq to act as advisers to local forces fighting insurgents. Critics worry that Australia will become enmeshed in another protracted war in the Middle East. But Mr. Abbott insists military action will make the nation safer.
It is in everyone's best interests that the murderous rage of the ISIL death cult be checked and rolled back, and that's what we're determined to do. ISIL has declared war on the world. ISIL is launching an assault on civilization, not just upon the people of Iraq right now.
The United States and Arab nations have been bombing IS targets in Iraq and Syria for some 2 weeks. More than 60 nations are now involved in the US-led mission, although most aren't carrying out airstrikes. European nations involved in the air campaign are only hitting targets in Iraq. The combat operation has the support of Australia's main opposition Labour Party. Its leader Bill Shorten says that military action alone can't drain the swamp of terrorism, and longer-term stability depends on the government of Iraq and its people. However, Greens leader Christine Milne believes that Australia's military action in the Middle East will increase the risk of terrorism at home. Milne accuses the Abbott government of taking Australia into a multi-year quagmire in Iraq. About 60 Australians are thought to have joined extremist groups in Iraq and Syria, and Canberra has raised its domestic terror threat level from medium to high. In recent weeks, counter-terrorism raids have been carried out in Sydney, Brisbane and Melbourne. New laws have been introduced to the Australian Parliament, giving the authorities greater powers to combat the threat of homegrown extremism. Last month, a teenage terror suspect was shot dead by police in Melbourne after 2 officers were stabbed. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
Moderate Syrian rebel field commanders say the U.S.-led air offensive in Syria is helping President Bashar al-Assad. Jamie Detmer reports from the Turkish-Syrian border.
Abu Mohammed, a moderate Islamist field commander, is in no doubt about his disapproval of U.S. strategy in Syria. He warns that the US-led coalition against the jihadists of the Islamic State is in effect bolstering Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. He says the Syrian president has taken the opportunity of the coalition airstrikes to refocus his forces, shifting some of them from eastern Syria, where they were fighting the jihadists, and reinforcing his own offensive against moderate and Islamist rebels in a key city of Aleppo. He says Syrian government airstrikes on Aleppo the past 2 days have increased in tempo and are terrifying. A former colonel in the Syrian army, Abu Mohammed, he says he defected after his superiors ordered him to shoot civilians, is now a top commander in the Syrian Revolutionaries Front. The SRF, an Islamist brigade that has fought alongside the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda affiliate, also targeted by American warplanes, says the rebels are at a disadvantage now in Aleppo. Once Syria's prosperous commercial capital, Aleppo has been seen as some of the most vicious fighting of the nearly four-year-long civil war, and about half of it is under rebel control. But since recapturing Homs, Syria's third largest city, several months ago, Mr. Assad has redoubled his efforts to regain total control of Aleppo, the loss of which would be devastating for the rebels. He says both Islamic State and Mr. Assad are taking positions from the rebels. Abu Abdullah, another commander with the SRF, says the Islamic State group is hard to fight, and the tanks and weapons they captured from fleeing Iraqi units around Mosul several months ago, when the jihadists launched an offensive in Iraq, are now being used against the rebels in Syria. He says the Islamic State fighters are coming from all over the world, but the jihadist field commanders he's battling tend to be Chechens or Gulf Arabs. Another rebel fighter from a brigade called the Lions of Tawid also says he's disappointed that the American-led coalition is not targeting Assad forces. Assad is the head of the snake and should be cut off, he says. US officials say their first priority is to degrade and defeat the Islamic State group in both Iraq and Syria, as it represents a global threat. The Obama administration is planning to screen 5,000 Syrian rebels and train them in Saudi Arabia. Some rebels say they're not interested in joining such a force, as it would take them away from the battlefield. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kilis.
Delegates at an international refugee conference agree humanitarian crises and needs are growing much faster than humanitarian agencies are able to respond. They say United Nations and private agencies have reached the limits of their ability to help and warn millions of refugees and displaced people around the world will suffer from lack of aid unless new, bigger sources of funding are found. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
There is a dramatic rise in global conflicts and in the numbers of people affected by them. For the first time since World War II, the number of refugees and displaced people now tops 50 million. But this hyperinflation of people in need of assistance is not matched by a corresponding increase in resources to help them. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, says aid agencies are overstretched because of the multiplication of conflicts and the exponential growth of needs resulting from natural disasters, the consequences of climate change, and population growth.
The humanitarian community has reached its limits. Either there is a quantum leap, either there is a substantive change, or we will no longer be able to respond. It will be impossible to deliver according to the needs of the people we care for with business as usual.
Guterres says many aid agencies have cut back on their humanitarian operations because of lack of money. He says headline-grabbing operations such as Syria, Iraq, and Ukraine are suffering from poor funding. But he says humanitarian operations in the largely forgotten African crises are at particular risk. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 15 million people in Africa have been forced to flee war and persecution, either across borders or within their own country. The High Commissioner tells VOA it is critical to focus international attention on the horrible tragedies occurring in countries such as the Central African Republic and South Sudan.
The levels of human suffering are perfectly comparable with the ones happening in Syria or Iraq, but of course there is much less attention, and there is much less political debate, and there is much less funding support. And so that is the reason why we convened this high-level segment, and we hope that it will contribute to raise awareness on the need to a stronger commitment of the international community in preventing conflict, in addressing the present conflicts with conflict resolution, and in increasing humanitarian aid to the different operations.
Guterres says it is time for governments and financial institutions to think outside the box. He says it is time to bridge the gap between relief and development aid. He notes development aid attracts roughly 10 times more money than does humanitarian aid. Therefore, he says, it makes sense that short-term and long-term development responses be linked. This would make more money available for emergency needs right at the start of a crisis. The United Nations currently has a so-called Central Emergency Response Fund from which agencies can draw money to pay for immediate critical emergency needs. However, this fund is supported by voluntary contributions and has little money in reserve. High Commissioner Guterres says the existing fund should be converted into a super central emergency response fund supported by mandatory contributions from member countries. This, he says, would make it possible for aid agencies to draw upon a much bigger pot of money to help them contend with bigger emergencies as they arise. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. South Africa has entered an agreement with Russia to boost its nuclear energy capabilities in a nation where an estimated 3 million people still don't have electricity. But the multi-billion dollar deal has its critics, who say the project is too expensive and too risky, and that they want more transparency. Anita Powell has more from Johannesburg.
A recent deal between South Africa and Russia over nuclear power has mushroomed into something of a political meltdown in South Africa. On September 22nd, the two countries signed a nuclear energy strategic partnership agreement on the sidelines of the International Atomic Energy Agency conference in Vienna. Few details were released, but South Africa says Russia may supply as many as 8 nuclear plants, which together will generate up to 9,600 megawatts of power. No one in South Africa disagrees that more electricity is badly needed. The nation's statistical agency says at least 11% of South African households do not have power. The nation's electrical grid is under heavy pressure, as no new power plants have been built in decades. Eskom, the parastatal energy company, has struggled to bring online another coal-fired power station, but the opening has been repeatedly delayed. But, as is becoming increasingly common in South Africa, the controversy here lies not with the intent of the deal, but with the deal-makers. The nation's top opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, has cried foul, saying the agreement needs to be made public. They point to a draft agreement they saw last year, which gave Russia the power to veto South African trade with other nuclear providers. Lance Grayling is a DA's shadow minister for energy and says his party is very concerned about the deal.
Well, we have a number of problems with it. Firstly, there's a lot of confusion as to what the nature of this deal is. What the government is saying at the moment is that they've just signed a framework agreement with Russia and that there will still be a procurement process that is followed. But what we are unclear about is what exactly is in this framework agreement. And the fact that they're not willing to show it to us, that makes us highly suspicious.
The government's Deputy Director General for Nuclear Energy did not answer more than a dozen calls seeking comment. But in a written statement to the media, the president's office denied there has been anything untoward in the nuclear energy program, and the president has worked closely with his cabinet on the Russian deal. It also denied that Russia would have a monopoly on nuclear energy deals with South Africa. Noxin Sebenzi, managing director of the Nuclear Industry Association of South Africa, says this deal is not worth getting too worked up about.
The agreement with Russia is one of many agreements similar to the agreement that has been signed with South Korea, and it will be similar to future agreements with China, France, and other interested parties.
South Africa's government already decided in 2008 that more nuclear power is needed. The nation runs one nuclear facility already, and Msebenzi says their successful track record is a good sign.
We are not different from any other country in the world that has got nuclear, coal, gas, hydro. There's nothing different about South Africa, and we've been operating nuclear power plants for the past 30 years.
But this argument will not be settled by engineers like Msebenzi. Nuclear power is a touchy subject due to its costs, its risks, and its environmental toll. And in this fight, the battleground will be the halls of Parliament. Grayling says if the government has nothing to hide in the deal, then it needs to share details of the arrangements with lawmakers.
As a DA, we are not ideologically opposed to nuclear energy. I mean, we believe that it's a good technology and that if it is affordable and makes sense for the country, then certainly we should pursue that. But unfortunately, what we have seen in a number of, in fact, government documents, including the latest update on the 20-year energy plan, is that there is huge concern over the impact that it will have on our electricity price, whether it will be affordable.
Experts say that the additional nuclear power won't come to South Africa within the next decade. The government's new coal-fired plant, the Medupi Power Station, is slated to come online by the end of this year and will add 4,800 megawatts to the grid. That plant, though, will have cost more than $10 billion by the time it opens in December. The ultimate cost of South Africa's nuclear expansion is still unknown, though nuclear facilities' upfront costs are much higher than those of traditional facilities. But, as Msebenzi argues, nuclear power will also bring side benefits in the form of industry, technology, and jobs. The head of Russia's nuclear provider estimated that this new deal could bring in at least $10 billion worth of investment and industry to South Africa. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The first case of Ebola here in the United States was diagnosed this week in Dallas, Texas. And the infected person is a man from Liberia who spent a few days with family members before being admitted to a hospital and put in isolation. The fear that he may have infected others is especially strong in the area's Liberian community, which, as VOA's Greg Flakus reports from Dallas, is already struggling to help families devastated by the disease back in Africa.
News that a Liberian in Dallas had become the first person in the U.S. to be diagnosed with Ebola pained local Liberians like African food store owner Stephen Joe.
A lot of people are kind of quiet, you know, because more likely it's kind of embarrassing because we don't expect this to be going like this, you know. So it's kind of embarrassing to the Liberian community as a whole.
Joe says a lack of good sanitation and health infrastructure has fostered the spread of Ebola back in Liberia. Now that it's arrived here, he advises great caution.
Don't try to shake other people's hands, you know. Just the African way, most of the time you see people, you greet and shake their hand. Try to avoid that.
Health officials say Ebola is transmitted only by people who display symptoms. But many people here fear the deadly virus after having lost family members to it in Liberia. Relieving their grief over such loss is a challenge for the Reverend Nathan Kortu, who ministers to a large Liberian congregation in Euless near Fort Worth.
Every Sunday we come here, people are crying, they get heard the news, somebody lost their family back home.
The congregation has been collecting donations of money and medical supplies to help fight Ebola in Africa, but Kortu says now the threat is here.
Honestly, every one of us are worried, including myself. But now we have to deal with this on two fronts. So that's what's making it very difficult for us.
There are 10,000 Liberians scattered across Dallas, Fort Worth, and their many suburbs. But they're linked together by the Liberian Community Association of Dallas-Fort Worth, whose president, Stanley Gay, worries Ebola could become a stigma for Africans.
Not everybody from Liberia or West Africa or from Africa will be affected, so I don't want people to have that stigma about Africans.
The Liberian man being treated for Ebola in a Dallas hospital has been identified as Thomas Eric Duncan. Gay says he does not know him, but he has been able to contact his wife by telephone.
I just was giving her some moral support from the community, letting her know that we are out there praying for she and her family.
That's also the theme Reverend Kortu emphasizes for the whole community and their loved ones back in Liberia.
Liberia, we are resilient people. We go through this. We are going through war. This is yet another situation that will come in our country that we trust in God that we'll be able to have a victory over it.
Officials from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have conferred with members of the Liberian community here to help educate family members back in Liberia on the best ways to avoid contracting the disease and spreading it to others. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Dallas.
Well, thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.